It was April 1977 when Jay Perrin opened Jay's Longhorn Bar in downtown Minneapolis. He introduced a new format there by hosting original rock music. Now bands such as the Flame & O's, Thumbs Up, the Suicide Commandos, the Suburbs, and more had a Minneapolis venue to perform original rock music. Musicians who were there remember. Curtis A. of Thumbs Up.
Wham! It was a scene. It was friends of friends.
The Suburbs' Chan Poling.
The Longhorn was the coolest bar in Minneapolis in, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
Suicide Commandos, Chris Osgood.
It was the Cognoscenti that would come down and be a part of the scene. And it was a real scene. You know, there were girls and everything. So it was a place that you would want to be. And that was attractive to people that were into music and were bright and wanted to write about the scene.
NNB's Richard Champ.
The scene in its very early stages was spreading by word of mouth. Oh, God, go down to the Longhorn. That is such a trip. The bands are so great.
Twin Tone record label co-founder Peter Jesperson.
I think everybody could kind of feel something beginning, just a very heady time where we really felt empowered. When Kurt came along and Thumbs Up came along, it was really refreshing because they were tapping into the mix of things like Beatles and Rolling Stones and The Who and that sort of stuff, but they were also mixing in there a lot of the American rhythm and blues. Wilson Pickett was a big favorite. James Brown, he had sort of the raspy voice and he could really belt it out. We likened him to Mitch Ryder a little bit, like a white guy who could really sing soul music very well. But there was also that blend of soul with British Invasion. A unique sound, really. And when we were coming up on the time that Twin Tone started, I just thought Kurt needed to be recorded and there needed to be records made of Kurt because he was such an important figure on the local scene. We've often said that Twin Tone was practically forced into existence just by the number of great groups of which, you know, Kurt, Suicide Commandos, Flamingo, etc., were the most popular people in that kind of burgeoning scene. It was a real exciting time because you could just feel something starting to develop, and we were right there on the ground floor.
Chan Poling, Chris Osgood, and Dave All described the Longhorn Bar.
Thanks for coming down on Thursday night.
Was right on 5th Street, and you'd walk in, and it was just a low-ceilinged, cement-floor rock room with a little stage at the end. We could fit the Suburbs up there, so it was maybe a little smaller than the First Avenue stage, but the thing is, it was you'd just step up onto it. And then along one wall, there was a long bar. The end of it was close to the stage. I remember that specifically because Steve Kramer, one night during a Wallets gig, leapt off the stage onto the bar and grabbed the cash register and ripped it out and was handing out money from the cash register. But just yeah, just a long, low, long room. Lots of beer drank there. Lots of rock.
It was a supper club. It had red-flocked wallpaper, dark wood paneling.
The carpeting was all Longhorn. The idea was that it was supposed to look like a Western saloon a little bit. It was like a garish Western saloon with low-hanging wrought iron chandeliers that were like wagon wheels.
Wagon-wheely kind of things.
And there was a DJ booth in the corner where Peter Jesperson set up shop, and he would introduce the bands.
Would you please welcome Twin Tone recording artists, The Suburbs.
Thank you. Chubby Voodoo.
Whoa!
The musicians who played the Longhorn Bar remember the scene and their audiences. Guitarist Slim Dunlap.
People were impressed by something different.
Chan Pulling.
It differed from the West Bank scene in that it was electric and loud. You know, high volume rock. A lot of eccentric kind of new bands were coming through there, you know, and there certainly weren't many adults there. But definitely it was the Converse tennies and peg leg pants kind of and leather jacket crowd, definitely. So it was pretty young and was pretty rowdy. You always look back through rose-colored glasses and think, oh, the place is packed with... But I saw a picture from back then. It used to get pretty packed. It'd get shoulder to shoulder, people just cramming in there to see this new kind of rock. But it was definitely alternative. If there are any punks in the town, which were there were a few, that's where they'd go. Kind of a party crowd, definitely. There was some illicit materials around.
Music fan and DJ Kevin Cole.
The Longhorn, people danced. So that whole area in front of the stage was packed with people. It wasn't like a mosh pit kind of thing where punk rock ended up going. It was more pogoing and just thrashing about.
My name's Lori Barbero. I'm from Babes in Toyland, and I used to work at the Longhorn in, I think, 79 or 80. It was pretty raw back then, but there was a huge unity between musicians and fans and just kind of like people who hung out. Everyone just went out to see a show just to, you know, go out and just have fun. And people danced a lot more.
Peter Jesperson and Suicide Commandos' Steve Almas remember the type of people that went to the Longhorn.
People were generally accepting of different kinds of music and different kinds of, you know, attitudes.
There was a core group of people that just hung out there all the time. Art students, college students, a lot of other people in bands.
I'm Kevin Cole, former First Avenue DJ and DJ at KJ104 and Rev105. I started going to the Longhorn just as a music fan. I just went by myself. Every time I was home, I would go there, and every summer I would go almost every night. Didn't matter who played, I'd show up when the doors opened and I'd listen to Peter Jesperson DJ. It was all exciting because here was this place that was booking these bands that didn't really have anywhere else to play, that weren't cover bands, that were playing original music. But there were, it seemed like, a handful of really, really good bands that you could see on a regular basis there. The Flamingos or Flamingo, Fingerprints.
Curtis A and Thumbs Up were one of the first bands to play the Longhorn Bar. Guitarist Slim Dunlap remembers.
The Spooks was one of the first or second band to ever play the Longhorn. So Kirk gets a lot of credit as far as the generating of that scene. There was the Suicide Commandos that kind of just came out of left field and inspired a lot of bands locally to dare to be different.
The Suicide Commandos, punk rock, even more so than the Ramones, just like wham. There's no veneer. I love those guys.
There were obvious bands that I love. Like if the Commandos were playing, I knew it was going to be a great night. The Suicide Commandos, they're considered sort of the granddaddies of the whole Minneapolis music scene. They were incredibly exciting and super fun. I'd go to every Suicide Commando show. A great release of pent-up energy. Chris Osgood would have a milk crate that he'd stand on and play so he could kind of rise above the crowd. And it was a great combination of just intensity that had a certain element of danger and occasional anger, but was more just overwhelmingly fun. I really, really liked NNB.
And of all the bands from that era, N&B or what Mark Freeman did after that, Red House, that was a whole different vibe. There was a dark kind of television meets Talking Heads edginess to those bands.
My name is Peter Jesperson, and I am the senior vice president at New West Records based in Los Angeles, and I basically run the A&R department. I've done that for the last 11 years, approaching my 40th year in the record business.
Peter Jesperson was the in-house DJ at the Longhorn during the late 70s.
I was kind of the main DJ at the Longhorn for most of that club's existence. There's people that said that kind of approach was really important to them, like Kevin Cole. You know, he used to come down and listen to, you know, us spin records at the Longhorn. And I think the Anything Goes approach is something that he appreciated and adopted.
Even going to hear Peter Jesperson spin was great. He was doing in a club setting what I kind of wanted to do on the radio, which was just be a freeform DJ full of surprises, defying expectation.
Along with the Suicide Commandos, the Flamin'Os played the Longhorn. They were the first band there and the favorite of music critic Martin Keller.
They had probably the most accessible sound, kind of an uncompromising sound with commercial edges. Robert Wilkinson was a great songwriter, and they were a terrific band to see live.
Robert Wilkinson of the Flamin'Os, formerly Flamingo and before that Prodigy, started learning music as a child and wanted to rock out at an early age.
They were actually trying to make me read and learn music, so I wanted to rock out, and I didn't want to take that time to do all that. So I got out of it until I was 12. And the Beatles came out. You know, that's when I wanted to get back into music and pick up the guitar again. But when the Stones came out, that was really it. I remember sitting in my parents' basement listening to England's newest hitmakers, which is the Rolling Stones' first album, and trying to learn the chords and the leads to the songs. Keith Richards was a really big influence on me. And that's when I earnestly began my journey into music.
Flamingo had to rename themselves. Robert Wilkinson recalls Curtis A's hand in forming their new name.
We didn't change to the Flamin'Os till about 1980 after Johnny Ray left Flamingo. We were four-piece at that time, and we recorded, made our first album, then changed it to the Flamin'Os because there was also an R&B band called the Flamingos, and they heard about us and said, that's a little too close for comfort, boys. So we changed it to the Flamin'Os, and that was actually Curtis A's doing. On the marquee one night outside on the Longhorn. So he separated the O from Flaming. It was Flaming O. We took that and ran with it. We dropped the G, put the apostrophe up there, had the H and apostrophe S, just because that was weird. We just liked the idea that it was weird and didn't mean anything. But we started playing the Longhorn and the Blitz as Flamingo for a couple of years.
Wilkinson talks about the Flamin'Os' inspiration and stage presence.
A lot of the bands that we liked that influenced us were bands like The Who, The Stones, and bands who always really put on great shows. And we wanted to emulate that. Rock and roll is meant, you're meant to have fun and jump around a lot and let the music carry you where you'll let it carry you. But that's the music. That's where the music takes you. It's not a fake energy, and it's not a fake, oh, I have to do this tonight, I don't feel like it. You know, you get up there and boom, you're gone. You know, it's like once that kicks in, say bye, baby, because you're gone for the night. You're going down that musical highway, and who knows where it's going to lead you. But hopefully it'll be a lot of fun.
The suburbs had a large, unusual practice space in the Podani Furniture Warehouse.
When we were first starting out, we used to rehearse in the basement of Podani's Furniture Warehouse on Lake Street. We had the greatest place. Actually, Beege and I lived down there, too. It was like living in a dungeon of a horror castle. It was really very punk rock. We had a 2,000-square-foot basement. It was kind of this weird ghost town. I've been underground. There's a rat skeller in this barber shop that was all connected, but it had been sealed off from the street above. And so we lived down in this little subterranean world, and we'd just rehearse and practice and practice and practice.
The Longhorn was under new ownership by then.
What happened was there was a guy named Hartley Frank that came along right around the time of M80.
This was a relation to Jay Bereen, I think probably a cousin. And Jay had some legal problems and could no longer run the bar, so Hartley took it over.
And then everything changed after that. And he was a real character, but he was not supportive of the scene in the same way. And yeah, we all had our adventures with him.
Uh-huh. The idea of a young band doing all original material, this wasn't flying. We weren't allowed, asked, or wanted to play in any bars. I remember that because the booker of the Longhorn was a guy named Hartley Frank, and he said no, he wasn't interested in having us there. But at the same time, Commandos and the Hipsters and the Suburbs and NMB and those kind of bands, we were all hanging out together. And so our studio, since it was so big, became kind of a party scene. It got to the point, you'd come down, you'd pay a buck at the door, we'd have a keg. You get a beer and listen to the Hipsters play and then the Suburbs play, all in this big, giant, echoey basement.
It's called a Slow Death.
And I got to the point where our parties were drawing more people than were going to the bars. And I remember one night, I was standing at the door taking them the dollar bills. You know, the line was going up the stairway up to the sidewalk. We had a few hundred people coming down there, and I think we were going to play that night, and Hipsters, and down the stairs comes Hartley Frank. I think he just kind of mumbled something at me, and he paid me a buck, and he went in and hung out, and we played, and we had a crazy scene down there. And the next day he called and said, would we come and play at his bar? Because he could see that we were drawing more people.
When those guys walked through the door at the Longhorn, things changed down there in a lot of ways, I think. They brought in a whole new crowd from the western edge of the metropolis. You know, they were dressed very elegantly. You know, they were elegant punks, basically, with great compositional skills and a couple of wild cards on stage, Beege Cheney and Chan. But Beege was always fun to watch. You know, they would pack the place in pretty short order. Some of the early regulars there, I think their first impression was, who the hell are these guys and why are they in our club? But they quickly became, you know, one of the champions of the club, and their popularity grew really rapidly, probably more so than any of the other bands.
You know, the Suburbs, they came along in, I guess, in 1977. They were a classic, although they weren't really a punk rock band. I looked at them as sort of more of an art rock sort of band, but they had certain punky elements, and they had, you know, one of the classic punk elements, which was that, you know, they got together as a group of people and not necessarily a group of musicians. I think Michael Halliday, the bass player, actually didn't know how to play the bass before he joined the band. I think that they just, you know, he was their friend. He looked cool, and they wanted him in the group, and they taught him to play the bass. You know, Chan was obviously a gifted musician. Bruce Allen was a phenomenal guitar player. Hugo's a great drummer. You know, Beege, great rhythm guitar player, etc. But when Twin Tone picked them as one of the first bands, a lot of people were really pissed off about it. And there's a famous quote, actually. Jay Bereen said to me,
when he found out, he said, well, I can see her wanting to record, you know, Kurt, and I can see you wanting to record Fingerprints, but the suburbs, he said, Peter, they sound like they stepped right off the playground and onto the stage. I just laughed, and I said, what a great thing to say. I said, you mind if I quote you in the press release? I said, that's a brilliant summary of what they do, and it really was true. They were just like these little kids who were just full of enthusiasm and excitement.
This one's dedicated to rock and roll, whatever that is today and now. It's called Bongo Rock. What do you think?
Coming from L.A., it was more flamboyant there. So I remember showing up one night, they had, you know, pants that were taped up with electrical tape and ripped and had paint spattered on them and big high-heeled boots and spiked up hair and plastic coat made out of bags. And so I think I stuck out a little bit. But and Beej always dressed crazy, still does. And I remember it really was exemplified in this article that came out in the U of M paper, The Daily. It's a big picture of Beej from the Longhorn with his goggles on. It was a dual review. It took up the full front page of the entertainment section. And the title of the article was The Suburbs, A Blight or a Blast? Down the left column was the blight side of you. And the guys just went on in a very review early way and said how bad we were and why we stunk. And then on the right side, the blast review was how great we were.
Guitarist Slim Dunlap talks about Twin Tone record label.
So you always kind of knew you were doing good if Peter showed interest in you. And it was a time where it was very difficult for most bands to afford making a recording, much less putting it out on any kind of actual label that would garner publicity. So Twin Tone was a very key thing for a lot of bands. There were other labels back then that sure played a key part in it, but Twin Tone was kind of a tastemaker label where if Twin Tone would take it, it was a good thing for your band back then.
The Minneapolis Twin Tone record label was formed in 1977. Paul Stark was a recording engineer for P. David Studios in Dinkytown. He met with Charlie Hullman, a music enthusiast and sports writer turned music writer for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, about forming a record label. They asked Suicide Commando's Chris Osgood about it. They wanted Osgood to join them, but he was busy touring with the Suicide Commandos and teaching guitar at Nootka Pay Music Store. He introduced them to Peter Jesperson.
Paul Stark noticed that there were about these 1,000 people that went out to support us, Curtis A., Flamingo, Flamingos.
Consistently.
And he thought, wow, if these 1,000 people would buy a record from each one of these bands, it could be viable to start a record company. That was honestly his thinking. And it worked. Charlie loved the Commandos, and he wanted the Commandos to be the first band signed to Twin Tone. He just loved us. And then just as we were going to be the first band, the offer from Mercury or from Phonogram came in, and we took that instead. But, you know, I went to work for Twin Tone a few years later, and you know, everybody stayed very good friends. And our next record was a Twin Tone record, as a matter of fact. Commandos Commit Suicide Dance Concert. But we had actually, the band had broken up. Commandos Commit Suicide was recorded Thanksgiving weekend of 78, and then posthumously we recorded 3 songs for Big Hits of Mid-American. Some of our most popular songs that we didn't get a chance to record until after we'd broken up. A little bit like that City Pages thing where in 77 we were in the named Best Band of the Year and Worst Band of the Year.
Osgood was instrumental in bringing Peter Jesperson to this new label.
He recommended that they talk to me because I ran the record store and DJed at the Longhorn. And Chris called me up and said, hey, I'm talking to these 2 guys who are interested in maybe starting a local label. I'd like to introduce you to them. And I believe we all met at Williams Pub
kind of a hang at the time. And I remember the four of us sitting down and talking, and that's really where seeds were sown. The night before the meeting, I literally had a dream. I had a dream of a record label called Twin Tone. And I like that. It still sounded good to me the next morning, and I brought that to the meeting, and everybody liked it, and how the label was named.
Each of the three brought different experience and expertise to Twin Tone record label. Paul Stark was business-minded and an excellent recording engineer. Charlie Holman was a music enthusiast and the financier. Peter Desperson was great at talent scouting and distribution. In January 1978, Twin Tone held an audition at Blackberry Way Recording Studio in Dinkytown.
Then we listened back to the stuff that we had recorded and tried to decide what came across best on tape, and that's where we decided on those three groups. Thumbs Up, Suburbs, and Fingerprints. And Kurt was a guy who always had a million names for his band, sometimes I think to his own detriment that he didn't stick to one name, but he always had fun having crazy names for groups. And so by the time we had done the recordings with Thumbs Up and we were ready to put the record out, Kurt had changed the name of the band to Spooks.
Peter Jesperson's work as a buyer for Orfolk Jokopis Record Store turned out to be beneficial for Twin Tone's record distribution.
Yeah, it was a nice little situation where I got to turn the tables on a lot of my sales reps who were calling me and selling me records. It's like, now I bought a lot of records from you over the years. Now it's your turn to buy some records from me.
The Longhorn was going, and then there was, you know, things started to spread out after that. You know, Duffy's came along, and Goofy's Upper Deck came along like a year or two later. And Husker Du was on the scene by that time. And, you know, that's when the things shifted and that new generation of bands came along. And with the Suburbs, there became the rage, you know, right after us, followed by the Replacements, followed closely by Husker Du. And then suddenly that was the scene in the mid-80s, and what a scene it was. You know, there was so much good music being written and recorded. It was all set up. You know, the infrastructure was there for the bands to record and to tour, too.
The Suburbs, I'd basically broken them up in 1979 or 80, something around there, and I'd moved to Chicago. So we just called it off. It was getting to be a drag. We quickly got back together and we played together. We played a couple of shows a year still.
You know, at the time when my pals and I were covering it, we used to kind of like stop and go, are we turning into cheerleaders for something that next week is not going to be so cool? But, you know, 30 years later, you know, a lot of these groups have left their mark and you listen to their records, they still sound great. So we were lucky to be where we were.
The music scene that Minneapolis developed is largely due to the wonderful audience that developed in Minneapolis for it, that would come support it and come hear your songs.
We were really, we just were a band. I'm sort of surprised and delighted that we can come back to it now again, and it's still, something just happens, and it's great.
It was amazing to be a part of that whole musical history of the Twin Cities, and it's not lost on a lot of us who are part of that, that's what was, it was definitely a change that was needed, but was also just incredible. It was the birth of alternative / indie music and punk.
We got in, we learned a lot, we made a noise, and we got out, and I'm kind of happy about that too.
This is Sin Collins for KFAI.
Funding for Miniculture on KFAI comes from listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Foundation.